Blog Talk Radio.
Scott Golden here with the Power of Perception Radio Network. Welcome, welcome to those of you who are new. Welcome back to those of you who are seasoned veterans. What we do around here, is we give folks of all different walks of life an opportunity to share with us their version of creativity. Pleasant Gaman will be with us in a moment here. A woman who is a Renaissance woman, everything from an author, journalist, international dance performer, tarot reader, and a whole bunch of other things. Pleasant has really taken the world by storm in nearly every form of creativity in one form or another for the last several decades. We're going to talk to her about the creative process, among other things, and also her love of music, her love of telling compelling stories, I'm sure, and so much more. Let's merge that call. Pleasant, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for taking time out of what I'm sure, just from your bio, is a super busy schedule. Give our listeners just a little bit of your background so they can know what we're going to talk about over the next hour or so.
You want me to do it? I'm
yes.
Sorry, it's really early. The phone cut out. Well, I've been active doing all sorts of arts and music and acting and just anything sort of obscure that you could think of, bands, painting, show production since the 70s. And I'm talking to you right now on 5 hours of sleep. I've written 8 books. I've got 2 more on the way. I do a show in Los Angeles. It's a cult-themed burlesque show with dancers and psychics. I'm a professional dancer. I teach all sorts of classes, everything from dance to stage makeup to paranormal investigation to branding. I'm pretty schizophrenic, all rolled into one person, all sorts of crazy stuff.
Wow, talk about a long history and a varied one at that. I'm interested in how does one get into a show on the, I guess, the spiritual or paranormal arts, as it were. Take us through the journey to get into that version and area of what you do.
Okay, well, the show is called Bell, Book, and Candle, like the Kim Novak movie about the beatnik witch in Greenwich Village, but we spell it B-E-L-L-E. And I've been a professional dancer for almost 30 years, and I've been reading tarot since the 70s. And I know a lot of people who work as psychics and dancers, and in some cases both. So this was just an idea that my co-producer, Shana Leilani, who's a newer dancer and a longtime psychic, we had this idea, and then we just started working on it, and it found a home like within 3 weeks of its conception, the show. And it started in May, and it's been selling out every night that we've done it, because obviously in Los Angeles, you know, there's a hotbed of occult stuff going on here, as there is in many cities. And by occult, I just mean the metaphysical in general, you know, anything from actual witchcraft practices to, you know, more new agey things and yoga and stuff. So I think people are really interested in in all sorts of magic, especially in these quote turbulent times we're having now. And you know, we knew the best dancers in town and around the world, actually. So we did one night, and the club, I think, was kind of skeptical, and it immediately sold out, and it's just been rolling along, and it's a really fun show to produce and be in, and the crowd is really fun and great and diverse, and we've now also just started an offshoot called Fortune Teller Friday, which is a psychic salon, and this is no dancing, it's only psychics, people doing a different amount of divination services, and that first one is happening tomorrow in Los Angeles. So,
what's the biggest misconception about the magic arts and I guess you said occult, but more of the, I guess, power of intention of energy that you've seen evolve over time? I know people's attitudes have changed into more acceptability of the new age, but what's the biggest misconception you think the mainstream public still has about that art form?
I think there's a few, but I think one of the main ones is just people are actually afraid of this. I mean, I think some of it might have to do with societal conditioning, or maybe they're religious, or even if it wasn't that practicing religion, it was just like ingrained thoughts. Like a lot of people are like literally scared to get a tarot reading or something like that, and they don't believe that they are or can be psychic, and they think it's like some kind of weird, crazy, woo-woo, dark thing, and that it's not just something that people are born with. Like it's, you know, psychics are called the sixth sense, and just like any other talent, people have them in varying degrees. But I think people are really afraid, a lot of people, of any kind of magic or intention or psychic things, because they've been trained to think that it's, you know, like odd and strange and, you know, not like a natural part of our makeup, you know. Like, I mean, if you want to get really like a really like funny cut and dried thing, I think it's almost
all right. Did we lose you? Let's see here. We don't have. Okay. Did we lose you? Pleasant, are you still with us? Let's see if we can reconnect. It seems that we've lost sound on Pleasant's side here. I'm not quite sure what the challenge is. I know that sounded like there was a little bit of crackling on the phone line. So maybe there were either some spirits at work or some bad technology or a little bit of both. I don't quite know what the challenge was there. We can see if we can make that reconnection. Let me reach out to her via social media really quickly. For those who are new around here, this is the Power of Perception Radio Network. We've got over 300 shows available in the archive on a variety of topics. And ultimately, there we go. Let's see if this tries again here. All right, Pleasant, are you back with us? We lost you there for a second. And
yes,
we lost all sound from you. Yep,
you
there
now?
Was just a little bit of crackling on your line, and then we lost you. We lost you completely for a second there. So we tried to see if you could reconnect. Anyhow, you were about to tell us a story of people's perceptions as it relates to those spiritual arts.
I think that people are just sort of societally conditioned often to be a little bit afraid of them or wary of them, you know. Some of it's cultural, some of it's the way that it's been portrayed in the media, some of it has to do with like the religious values that people were raised in, like they're taught to think that it's, you know, something weird and odd as opposed to like a natural kind of gift or sense that most people have and something that can be developed, you know. I think that's why they're afraid of it. And not everyone is. It's getting a lot more open now. People are a lot more interested in it. And I think this is also kind of cyclical, you know, probably like the last time it was really, really big, or as big as it seems to be now, was in the 70s, you know, late 60s, early 70s. But a lot of people are getting a lot more open to it, and they realize that it's not, you know, it's not some weird woo-woo thing, you know. There's, like, I have a lot of clients for tarot, and I know other people do, that ask about business decisions all the time. And if you look back in history, I mean, like, you know, Napoleon had a fortune teller. Ronald and Nancy Reagan had Jean Dixon as their astrologist. I mean, there's all sorts of connections, and it's a study like anything else. But a lot of the people are psychically gifted, and they don't realize it.
All right, and so for those who aren't as educated to that part of the world, the psychic arts, the art of divination and such, what is the ideal purpose of a tarot reading? Is it for enlightenment? Is it for path choices? What's its ideal usage and purpose?
I think it's like a little roadmap or blueprint of where you are right now. And if any of your listeners have never had a tarot reading, it often comes up as exactly like a snapshot of what's going on with you right now. And then there's predictive kind of, there's usually like a predictive aspect to it. But most tarot readers believe that, you know, all people have free will and that the future is mutable, you know. Also, I think a lot of people misunderstand the actual tarot cards, because when they look at some of the images, especially of the traditional decks, you've got to know that many of those were drawn hundreds of years ago, and they do look a little scary. Some of the cards on the older decks look brutal, but you know, a lot of that was fostered by B movies, you know, like there'd be like some murder mystery on, and the hangman would appear and the soundtrack would go dun dun dun. And so people nowadays don't realize, you know, that they're just like learning the movie version. But I think a lot of people look at it now for in a holistic way, and in a way where they can get to know themselves. And people that aren't practicing tarot know that they can probably find a reader that's not going to, you know, tell them a curse has been put on them and scam them. But it's a way to connect to, like, the situations in your life, your unconscious and subconscious motivations, and give you, like, a gentle nudge towards what you need to welcome into your life.
You know, it's really interesting, because if you look at the history of the tarot, and you look at the history of how people relate to it, you also deal with a lot of people use it when they need inspiration of creativity, which leads us into another aspect of your history, which is being involved in the early punk music scene. Talk to us a little bit about the beginning of the scene, but also how you've seen punk music as a genre evolve over the last several decades.
Well, I got into it in the 70s when I was a young teenager, or, you know, a middle-aged teenager. I was about 16, and I was fortunate enough to live in Los Angeles, so there was a lot of rock and roll going on, no matter what genre. Punk rock started here in L.A. It was going on in New York and London, too. It sort of sprang up around the same time in all the major cities. And it basically started as a sort of revolt against, you know, the bland music that was getting shoved down everyone's throats by Top 40 Radio, as well as sort of a pushback towards society, you know, a rebellious kind of thing. And punk rock was here in Los Angeles anyway, was very creative. It was very fun. Some of it seemed threatening or wild or shocking, but not to the people that were doing it, you know, everyone that was into it. And at that point in LA, it was everyone from teenagers like me to people that had, you know, migrated to California from New York and the Warhol scene, or from San Francisco and the beat scene. There was a wide age range. It wasn't only teenagers. It was like people in the typical, like, you know, 18 to 34 demographic that was involved in it. And it was really also an art movement too. Everyone was doing things, creating things, like making clothes, taking photographs, starting clubs. You know, I had a fanzine. It was a really vital time to be around a music scene or to be a teenager. And I, even at the time, likened it to Paris in the 20s or to, you know, Greenwich Village in the 50s. And at the time, I thought I was like just, you know, maybe being an idealistic teenager. But now, like, you know, 40, cough, cough, years later, I see what a truly amazing time it was, you know, and you can still see and feel the effect everywhere. Like, you look at any ad, and a lot of them have, you know, sort of 70s punk-influenced graphics, you know, music like the Cramps and Iggy Pop are getting used in, like, national advertising campaigns. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you see it, and I think people are still really interested in it. Lots of the music still holds up today. The values of it, the DIY ethic, the rebel against things that you're not satisfied with thing, all still really resonate, especially now today in American society anyway.
You mentioned, too, having written, you said 8 books, 2 more on the way. Obviously, building a core following in something like music has impacted how you connect with an audience as a writer, I'm sure. So take us through, you mentioned writing kind of a fanzine, which I think for our internet-based age, they may not even know what that is. So obviously bulletins for, you know, folks who were interested in a certain form of entertainment in the 70s and 80s up until the internet age, it was done predominantly through mailing lists, right? So take us through starting something like
mailing lists. Not even mailing lists in the 70s, because who could afford the stamps? It was like handed out on the street or passed out in record stores.
Oh, wow. So it was even more grassroots than a mailing list or a newsletter would be. I did not realize that.
Not even like that. And then also, like, when I was doing it, I mean, not just because I was a broke teenager, but there you couldn't even afford Letra Set or Press Type, which I think the audience really might not know what that is. It was these rub-on letters that you would buy at the stationery store, like sheets of rub-on alphabets that people used for graphic design before there was any kind of computer action going on in graphics. And when I could afford my first set of Letra Set writing letters, which was really expensive, it was like, I think it was like $1.95 for the sheet. I was like, woohoo, I've arrived.
And now you can go and order, you know, pressed on t-shirts for $100, you can order 20 t-shirts, but it's such an interesting time, the difference in the last 40 years or so.
Internet.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is, how have you found the difference now for entertainers in any genre, from writers to musicians to spiritualists, in terms of building a following? How is it different than when you started, but also, is the quality of building a following different now versus several decades ago?
Yes, I think that there's a sort of a double-edged sword here. One of the things it was amazing and unique, I think, about punk rock in particular, was that it was the last, at least the way that I see it, it was the last youth movement to begin organically and be completely unscathed by any kind of like co-opting or marketing, because it existed underground for so long. It seems like now if someone has a band, they're immediately like, you know, they're immediately either signed by a large label or putting like songs or records or something out, because you can do all of that for free now so easily, or for a very minimal cost compared to what it used to be like technology-wise. You know, you used to have to like, there was no such thing as a home studio or garage band in those days. You couldn't just edit a song on your computer or like clone music. You had to like save up to get something recorded, or you had to record it on a crappy like Sony cassette player, you know, and then you had to get the money to press the vinyl and stuff. There was no digital thing for music, just the same as like what I was telling you about my fanzine. You know, you would take it to a Xerox place. You couldn't just like send it into Vistaprint. And then you couldn't just post it on the internet. You'd have to physically bring it to like a record store or a bookstore to have it sold. I mean, that kind of thing has changed leaps and bounds for any kind of creative artist. You know, you can draw digitally, you can record digitally, you can make a fanzine or something, except now it's called a blog. I mean, that is huge and revolutionary for someone that's as old as I am. But also now, I think one of the things that is a little bit disheartening to me or to other people that have been around for so long is just how instantaneously commercial everything becomes immediately, and any kind of artist doesn't truly have a chance to develop like undisturbed in the way that it used to be. And it's not like I'm pining for the olden days where it took a long time to get something made or to you know, for you to gain recognition or something, but it did leave the artist in whatever genre a lot of leeway to like develop and find their own voice or their signature style or whatever, you know, and you don't see that as much nowadays. You start doing something and it's immediately out there, and there's immediately like a t-shirt or a download to go with it, you know. So that's both great and not so good all at once. And then the other thing that is sort of magnificent about it, though, is that if you are doing something, you don't have to like necessarily slave away at a crappy day job in order to be able to finance it. If people like you and they start following your social media and buying your products and stuff, suddenly your art can be your day job, which is that side of it's very incredible for people. And people have told me many times, they're like, wow, you're so good at social media. How did you get to be this way? And I just say, and I'm not being, it sounds flip, but I'm not being sarcastic. I was like, well, it beats the hell out of wandering around town, going from show to show, passing out paper flyers.
Yeah, it social media is a long way from the street team, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough to remember thinking fax machines were magic.
I remember, and I'm a different generation than you, but I'm still, I am the 90s kid, and so the answering machine wasn't always a thing. Voicemail was only for rich people, and now I look at everybody with their voicemails, and I'm like, you don't remember what it was like to actually have to wait for a phone call and actually, you know, go out of your way to buy a machine that would record your messages.
Oh, yeah. When call waiting came in, it was like a godsend. I remember that. And then I also, I don't know if you experienced this because you're saying you were a 90s kid, but in the 70s, there used to be a thing called an emergency breakthrough. where you could call the operator and say, I need to make an emergency breakthrough, and then you'd state whatever number you wanted it to go to. And we would just do this to get us teenagers to, I mean, it wasn't made for teenagers. It was really supposed to be a real emergency. But my friends and I would always do it, and you'd be on the phone talking to someone that you'd been on the phone with for like an hour and a half, and all of a sudden the operator would come in and say, excuse me, I've got an emergency breakthrough from David Bowie. Will you accept? you'd like know that you needed to get off the phone and talk to someone else. I tell stuff like that to teenagers, and they're like just looking at, you know, at me in like I'm making it up, or that there didn't used to be like leash laws for dogs, or that you could call a number on the telephone and a recorded voice would tell you what time it was. It's like saying that, you know, you used to drive a horse and buggy or something. It's so funny.
I remember the wonder of 411 and dialing the operator to get a number. I also was in telemarketing for a while, and actually one of my jobs was to call directory assistants. You tell kids that there's a thing called directory assistants for a phone number, and they look at you very strange these days. So you've mastered the art of social media. What are the biggest mistakes that you see entertainers make in social media development of their brand that you just shake your head and go, all right, career killer?
Well, I teach classes on branding and marketing. And the main mistakes are that people make usually are really big and glaring, but it's because they don't understand the way social media functions. First of all, a lot of people do not have a website, a real website. They think a Facebook page is enough or something like that, you know, and that's still a huge mistake because your website is like your brick and mortar store, only it's on the internet, you know. And then the second thing is they, even though they're on the internet constantly, they don't understand how important images are. And so they don't have good pictures, you know, they don't have professional photos or interesting photos. And I'm not even just talking content wise on a social media feed. I just mean in general on a website or anywhere, you know, they don't realize that people want to see that, then they need to see that. And that's how they get the perception of you as either a person or a brand or an entity or an artist, you know? And then the third thing is, once they have a social media account or accounts, they don't use it enough and they don't use it wisely. Like, a lot of people do not understand that, like, anyone's social media feed on any platform goes by so quickly that there's almost, and I'm seeing almost in big letters, there's almost no such thing as overposting. Like, you can't just put one or two mentions of an event you have coming up or, you know, something that you're trying to promote. You can't just put it on there once or twice because it's gone in the blink of an eye. You have to do it at least daily, if not more. But you also have to, you can't just like sort of on the same way, you can't just like have it be the only thing that you're about. There's got to be interaction with others. And then the other thing I think that I can say that anyone would understand and is widely misunderstood is the use of hashtags. Like, people just do not understand what hashtags are. That it turns anything into a searchable term. But it's got to be something that someone would search for. Like, recently I was working with an artist, and they kept hashtagging the name of their house as opposed to, like, fine art or hand-painted or something. They didn't understand that, like, no one is going to search for, you know, the appellation they call their house. You know, like that's not a searchable term. I mean, people that know them might understand that, but like, it's not going to attract a stranger to the website. So, you know, figuring out, you know, what genre you're working in and what you are trying to highlight is key to your hashtags. So those are like probably the top things that I would say about social media for artists or anyone that's interested in doing it.
All right. So the next phase of promotion, obviously we're in a social media age. You're probably more ahead of trends because you've been through this before than most people. What are the trends that everyone's going to be talking about 5 or 10 years in terms of promotion as an artist, in your estimation?
Well, I think that artists are now one of the things that I think is sort of in its nascent stages, but it's starting to be like very widely accepted is like the concept of arts patrons, which has always been around, but getting internet arts patrons, like the site Patreon, you know. There's a lot of people that are willing to support artists, and I think artists are only just realizing that they don't need to be, quote, starving artists, you know, and that now through the internet you can find people that are willing to support you and your work and your art and whatever you're doing. And they can be total strangers. They just appreciate what you do. And for many artists, I think that's like, it's kind of like an aha moment, but it's also kind of unbelievable still to them. So I think that trend is going to continue. I mean, there's so many people that have, you know, would have been like sort of languishing in obscurity were it not for the internet, you know, that an artist's life can still be somewhat difficult and there can still be like, you know, day jobs involved or whatever, but it's getting so much easier to be able to have your art seen or listened to or any of that. So I think that's probably a big trend that's going to continue more and more as far as the internet goes and as far as at least five years out, maybe.
Having the benefit of having written books, what about information related to how people consume the written word or the spoken word? How has that changed since you started, wrote your first book to now? And what are the trends as far as dissemination of information that you see forthcoming?
Well, I think that, you know, we've all seen blogging really, like, change the way that news was perceived, but also the way that people's lives are perceived. I mean, there's multiple blogs on any subject you could think of, and some of them are incredible, and some of them are, you know, not very good, at least to, you know, to the way some people perceive them. But I think the internet has made that kind of writing, any kind of, you know, like journalism, when I was first starting as a journalist, which was, you know, in the 70s and continued on strong for over 25 years, people only read hard copy. Obviously, there wasn't an internet. When internet news or, you know, like arts and leisure type stories or any kind of story started coming out, there wasn't that much of it on the internet. And people were encouraged, not even encouraged, probably mandated if you were working for a publication not to write first person. And I think through the rise of blogging, but also through the rise of reality shows, everyone is seeing that first person is really interesting because everyone is always interested in, you know, what someone else is going through. I mean, that's the whole genre of human interest stories that have been around forever in you know, any kind of like biography or magazine profile piece or something. So people are really interested in seeing what other people are doing, no matter what form of media it's on. And I think that the personal aspect of blogging or even of social media, it's kind of like a voyeuristic a voyeuristic thing that interests people, but you can also discover a lot of great writers that way or great artists or anything like that. So that's going to continue a lot.
Your thoughts about, you mentioned the media aspect. Obviously now we're embroiled in the whole fake news scandal with this network, that network, and all these different outlets being at war with who's being honest. Is there completely impartial journalism anymore, or does the needs of the market create a bias within even the most well-intended journalist, in your view?
I almost don't think there's any kind of impartial journalism going on anymore. I mean, the stuff that's going on, like, politically and journalistically, I mean, especially with, you know, the White House right now, it's jaw-dropping. It's like, if you saw this on a daytime TV soap opera back in the day, nobody would believe it. I mean, it's the people in and out of the White House, all of that. I mean, and, you know, some of the scandals that have been, you know, like sort of uncovered with journalism or with whistleblowing. I mean, it's just out of control. And I think it was a lot easier to cover up pre-internet, you know, any of this. I'm sure it's been going on like this for centuries, but seriously, like it's more interesting than Game of Thrones almost, except it's real and it's shocking, you know. I don't think that anyone can be impartial anymore. It's like anything is making everything very divisive, you know. And
you mentioned a couple of. You mentioned upcoming books that you have coming out. How about we plug what you've already written, but also give people teasers as to what's forthcoming?
Okay. My most recent book of creative nonfiction is called Showgirl Confidential, My Life on Stage, Backstage, and on the Road. And it's a full-length book, but it's all short stories that were not embellished in any way about stuff that happened on the road from punk rock through the Arab Spring. And it's a pretty wild book. There's a lot of insanity in that book, just circumstantially. Really funny stories and really, really crazy stories. So that's all written first person. Another book that came out right after that is called The Belly Dance Handbook, which probably isn't going to be, you know, it's going to be a niche, very niche book for your listeners, but in, you know, on Amazon, it's like ridiculously highly rated. It's like sort of the definitive book on belly dancing. And the books that I have coming out, I've got a book that's called Lobotomy. That's the working title, but it's I'm doing it with photographer Teresa Caricas, and it's about the fanzine that we created in the 70s. My fanzine was called Lobotomy, the Brainless Magazine. It was named after a Ramones song. And last year, I opened a box that I hadn't looked at in ages, and it was sort of like Howard Carter going into King Tut's tomb, because I had all the issues of my 70s fanzine all in their original little brown paper bags with the receipts from the printer in it, with, like, you know, the hard copy photos glued to them. And so Teresa was the primary photographer, and she still has all the negatives, so we did art shows, and we actually teach together. We taught a fanzine making class at UCLA a couple of months ago. But we're putting together a book of the fanzine with her photos and, like, all the content in it and stuff. Then I've got a book on tarot coming out called Walking the Tarot Path. That book is almost completed. It's with my divination and writing partner, Crystal Ravenwolf. And it's a book that teaches the reader tarot, and, you know, it's sort of set up like a lot of tarot books. It's got all the meanings of the cards, but then we've also got, you know, sort of our own, like, twist on, like, a lot of things. And it's sort of, a lot of tarot books are kind of dry or very, very academic, so we kind of brought a little bit of affinity and humor and fun into it too. So that should be coming out pretty soon. We're in final edits with that right now. So those two are coming out sort of imminently, and they're self-published. But that's another trend. Self-publishing is not what it used to be. Self-publishing now is not a vanity press. Self-publishing now means that you don't have to, you know, give a percentage of your earnings to a publishing house that's basically just fronting you the money to publish it, like a small press or something. You can do it yourself. So that's another thing that's been great from Amazon and other platforms like that, you know, the ability to self-publish a book as an ebook or a hard copy.
Now, over the years, I've had a few tarot readings, and luckily I had some readers who were very blessed and talented folks who explained to me what different cards meant. Usually, from what I have heard, though, the death card or the concept of the death card scares a whole bunch of people, as we kind of mentioned earlier. So why don't we educate people as to the misnomers about the death card?
Okay, let's do that, because I pulled it on Instagram and Facebook the other night. Let me just tell all your listeners, if you want to follow me for a daily tarot draw or any other reason, my Instagram is at Princess of Hollywood. I do tarot every evening for the next day, and I actually pulled the death card. It was the card for yesterday. So the death card is just about changes and transformation. It almost never means literal death. You know, when you're reading a tarot card by itself, if I, like when I put a card on Instagram, for example, I will, I'll put all aspects of the card, but there's also nothing around the card. There's no other cards to inform what the meaning could be. It would be like if you reduced a paragraph or a sentence to one word. You know what the meaning of that word is, but you don't know it in context. And that's the same with tarot. So if I draw a daily tarot card, which I do, and it came up death, I would tell you what it said, that it means a time of transition, of change, of transformation. A lot of versions of the death card have the Grim Reaper on it, and when the scythe of the Reaper slices down, it cuts your experiences into two portions, kind of. I mean, I'm being very lyrical and allegorical here. So you get past and future. You know, the present is the break between them. So you're moving from one situation into another. But yeah, the death card, that's also something that's been popularized by B movies, you know, just like I was mentioning with the Hanged Man before. Those are, you know, people are afraid of that kind of stuff. And when they see an image like that, you know, which we can also thank a lot of, like, you know, heavy metal bands, 80s heavy metal bands for, they get scared, but they're not realizing that, you know, some of those images were drawn like, you know, 80 to 400 years ago. And that's why they look creepy. I mean, these are the same people that would be scared of the death tarot card are happily wearing a shirt from some mall that has skulls on it. So go figure. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is an internal hypocrisy of what people focus on. Now, for folks who might be interested, do you know the original origins of the tarot? Does it go back to a European derivation? Does it go back Egyptian? What's known about the original derivation of the art form going back hundreds of years, if anything?
Well, the oldest known tarot deck is called the Visconti Sforza deck, and it was a hand-painted deck made in Milan for the family of that name, Visconti Sforza. And I've actually seen that deck. It was at the Metropolitan Museum, the Cloisters, last year, and I felt like I was seeing the Holy Grail. I was standing in front of, like, the original images, just, like, marveling and almost crying. But the history of tarot is a little bit murky. I mean, we can only go on, you know, as almost with anything that's hundreds and hundreds of years old, we can only go on what we know to be the oldest or what we have heard to be where it came from. A lot of people think that the actual playing cards before there was divination done with them came from Egypt. And, you know, most people regard the Visconti Sforza deck as the earliest known deck. But they came from Italy. There was a card game called Tarocchi or Tarocchi. And people started using the cards for divination. And it went on and on. It was the same thing. I like to compare it to, like, yoga or martial arts, or in my case, belly dancing. If something's been around for hundreds or thousands of years, there's a good reason why. But over the years, there's now, like, at least three different general types of tarot systems. And one is the Rider-Waite-Smith, which is probably the cards that most people are familiar with when they think of tarot cards. It's, like, probably the most famous current deck, and that deck was drawn in the early 1900s. It was published in, I think, 1909. There's also the Toth deck, which was Aleister Crowley's deck, and which, again, not, you know, associated with magic, but not necessarily witchcraft-based. And then the oldest of the systems that are in use right now is called the Tarot de Marseille. And those images were drawn, you know, in Europe, and they're very similar to the Italian ones. And they're like woodcut blocks. And all of the tarot systems are similar, but some of them are numbered a little bit differently, and the drawings look different, and some of the cards have slightly different. You know, it would be like if you spoke a regional form of English, like I speak English, but if I was talking to someone with a Cockney accent or a strong Southern accent, I could understand most of it, but I might have to go, excuse me, I didn't understand the last few words. You know, that's kind of what the tarot systems are like.
So it's almost like a dialect type of thing based on the tradition from whence it originated. No,
yes.
Just
it's
almost like a dialect.
But, like, I could be sitting with, like, say, someone from, like, India or Czechoslovakia or something, and we could look at the same spread of cards, and we would both know what it meant, you know, or know what it meant with, you know, slight variations due to our perception of it. But yeah, it's its own language.
Right.
And so, you know, that's another thing that makes it very appealing. The images and the symbology on the cards are universal. They really, someone that didn't even know how to read tarot cards, if they were just presented with one card, they could get what was going on in it just by looking at it, you know? And we're very visually oriented as humans, you know? Which also goes back to, like, why you need good pictures on your website. Did I lose you? Hello? Did I lose you?